Okay, we got to verse 8 last week of 1 Timothy chapter 5, and then I said we'd start here. It's kind of a good starting point. The word provide or provision, if you break it down to pro and vision, what does that mean? What does the word pro mean? Before, okay, and vision?
To see.
To see, so provision is to see before. In other words, you're planning on something that's going to happen in the future. In order to do that, you have to think through everything that's going to happen, and then you have to provide for it. Well, in the Greek language, it's proneo, and neo means mind, so it means to think before. So it's a little different than the Latin word that we got, but we don't have noeo in our language except knowledge. I guess you could say prono, but if you said prono, most people wouldn't. But it has the idea of forethought. It has the idea of, I know I'm going to have to provide for my parents, and I know that when that happens, whether it's this year or 20 years or whenever it happens, I need to be ready. And that was part of the reason I think Jesus was so unhappy with the Pharisees, who said, you know, I could have helped you, but I've already promised it to God. Well, should they have done that? Should that promise have ever been made?
No.
In other words, if I know that this could happen, and I don't make provisions for it, then what kind of a person am I? It's like the guy today who is maxing out his credit cards and just living for the moment, and he knows something bad could happen, but he's counting on it not happening. When something bad happens, what do we say to him? Yeah, you kind of dug your own hole here. So if they come to the church and say, you know, I'm out of a job and I owe this much on credit cards and this much and this much and this much, and you're looking at them going, how in the world did you get here? Well, you weren't making provisions. You weren't thinking ahead. So if providing for our own is not exclusively taking care of them after the fact, it's making the plans before the fact so that when it occurs, you'll be able to take care of that situation. So if people don't do that, then they deny the faith. Carl?
10 virgins is a good example of that. 5 was foolish and 5 was wise. They prepared ahead of time.
Right. Yeah. And making provision, probably be a good sermon, wouldn't it? Making provisions, making plans for the future. That's why we obey the gospel, because we're making provisions. We don't want to stand before God on Judgment Day unprepared. So we want to make provisions so that doesn't happen. Excuse me. The Greek word for his own is the word that we get idiot from. It's the Greek word idios, and it means one's own or one's own mind. And the reason they use the word idiot, it was kind of fascinating. I always like to do the etymology on these words. And back in the 1800s, when this word kind of developed into what it now is, there were two kinds of people. There were lunatics that became insane after they were older, and then there were people who could never get out of their mind. They never could grow into the kind of person that could make decisions, and they called those people idiots because they could not. It wasn't, I mean, when we use the term today, what do we mean? I mean, it's a term of derision, right? It wasn't a term of derision then. It was simply a medical term. You had a lunatic and an idiot. A lunatic was somebody who became crazy after they reached the age of accountability, and an idiot was somebody who never, ever got out of that first phase. So it was actually a term of exemption, a term of rationalization, or a term of justifying. So
actually, there's 3 categories there. There's the idiot, the lunatic, and the moron.
Yeah. And we shouldn't use any of those terms today because they're not good terms. They fall into the Matthew that if you call your brother Raka, Raka is the same as an idiot and probably not a lunatic, although if we say you're crazy, we usually, that guy's crazy. Okay, way off topic.
Is that unbeliever? Which word are you talking about?
Idios, one's own.
Oh, one's own.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Providing for your own. So that's how it got into our language. But in the Greek language, it just meant what pertains to you. What is yours? And in this particular case, he doesn't elaborate. And that's why we talked last week about the fact it could be servants. It could be friends, could be people that you've brought into your home. If you've made a commitment to help these people, they're your own. And if you do not provide for them, then you have denied the faith. Now, let's go back up, especially his own household. Now, your own household is the Greek word for house. And, of course, house can be the structure or house can be the people in the structure. Literally, it would be belonging to the house. But in the Greek language, that would infer to them the family, like household of God. We don't. When we say house of God, what do you normally think of when you say, I'm going to go to the house of God? The building or the temple. But it's the same word, and house of God can also be the family of God. So your own house would be your own immediate family, which would be parents, children. And then I guess culturally it goes out from there, whether it's your brothers and sisters, whether it's your nieces and nephews, whether it's your aunts and uncles, would depend on the culture and the situation. So I don't know necessarily. I mean, how far out do you take it? Do I have a responsibility for my third cousin twice removed? Okay, George?
Well, when we consider the whole context of the chapter and so forth, it seems to me that when it says his own would be, as you say, those things pertaining to him, but when it says especially those of his own house, I think that's those living in with him, as you already said, but the first part would include the third cousins you're talking about, I think, or anyone else that you should be knowing that is a family member, I believe.
Right. I guess to the extent that you can. Robert?
Well, is it, there's also just general teaching about as we have opportunity to do good, and that would, you know, if we see there's a need and we have the ability to help. But this seems to be also focused in this verse, making sure we know that our where our immediate focus is, that's where the provisions need to be made, and that's where we have to. I mean, as opportunity arises, sometimes those aren't have-to things, those are if we can.
Right.
But this is a have-to. This isn't a, well, you know, you need to be serious about your obligations to those that you're to be a provider for.
Right. Carl?
We have the same category in Galatians 6:10. Provide for the household of faith, especially those of the household
right.
of faith.
Right, yeah. Okay, well, let's go ahead and move on then. I don't want to spend too much time on this because we covered it last week. I just wanted to touch a couple of things there. So let's go ahead and move to verse 9. And we have a really difficult situation here because we don't really know what this position is. I mean, it talks about enrolling someone. I've never seen it done. Have you ever seen it done? I mean, this is a practice that we don't really have in the present culture because I don't think we're clear on exactly what it means to be taken into the number. Now, we understand that the Catholic Church has their nuns, and those nuns have been, quote, taken into the number. But most of those nuns are not, they don't fit this category because this is a person who can't be, has to be over 60 and has to have some very specific qualifications, very similar to the qualifications of the elders. And so this is a verse that I guess I'd have to say it's an enigma because as far as I'm aware of, I've never seen, even the denominations, we don't practice this. We don't have an enrollment in the church. Now, some people say, well, this means you're permanently taking them into in other words, taking care of their needs until they die. But if that's all it was, then these qualifications and this pledge, the younger widow is going to reject a pledge, and this pledge that she rejects is going to put her under condemnation. So there's an event here, and I wish we knew more about it, and I guess because we don't know more about it, we have not actively practiced it because, as I say, it's just an enigma to us. Virgil?
Could some of this language be tied to, like in Acts 6, talking about the Grecian widows, specifically named? They had a problem, and they needed help in a systematic way.
Right, in the daily distribution. Yeah, they could very well have been in this situation, but what do we do with that?
Yeah, I know.
You know, you're right, but then you're going, okay, we've got this, let's go through it. But the problem we face here is we don't know where we're going. This is very similar to Roman or 1 Corinthians chapter 7, a very time-oriented passage, a passage for the present distress. And since we're not under that present distress, some of the things in that passage have to be carefully scrutinized, otherwise we get the wrong idea. And so that's kind of where we are here. Let me just read through the section, and then we'll kind of come back and we'll talk a little bit about it. It says, "Do not let a widow under 60 years old be taken into the number or enrolled, not unless she has been the wife of one man, well reported for good works, brought up children, lodged strangers, washed the saints' feet, relieved the afflicted, diligently followed every good work. Refuse the younger widows, for when they have begun to grow wanton against Christ, they desire to marry, having condemnation because they have cast off their first faith or their first pledge. Besides this, they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but also gossips and busybodies, saying things which they ought not. Therefore, I desire that the younger widows marry, bear children, manage the household, give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully. For some have already turned aside after Satan. If any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them, and do not let the church be burdened, that it may relieve those who are really widows." So, as you go through that, you can see, first of all, is this a financial thing? I mean, that goes without saying, right? It's a financial thing, because if they have believing children, then what's supposed to happen?
They should take care of them.
They are going to relieve the church. They are not going to burden the church. So, clearly, this widow indeed is going to burden the church, right? In the sense of financial, taking care of them financially. But there's also a pledge in this enrollment, which if they break it, then they have sinned, and so that's why. And because they've taken this pledge, they have opportunities to work, but instead of working, these people are being idle, wandering about from house to house and busybodies, which infers anyway, if not necessarily infers, that these older widows are going from house to house. These might have been the older women. What are the older women supposed to do for the younger women? Train them how to love their husbands. How do they do that? Well, they go from house to house and they talk to the women. They sit down with them and they work with them. So, but as I say, I mean, you build this wonderful scenario and then you come back and you say, well, it's just speculation. Because what we have is we have the concept of an enrollment, the qualifications for the enrollment, the pledge for the enrollment, the forbidding of widow, younger widows to be in the enrollment, and then what? Then we're kind of looking at it going, okay. As I say, I think any church that had a widow would take care of her. Would she have to be 60 for a church to say, we're going to help you with your financial needs?
No.
No, she wouldn't have to be 60, so that's not the enrollment. Would she have to have washed the saints' feet? Would she have only had to have one husband? Would she have to be lodging strangers? Are those things that we would require of a widow before we would say we can help you? So you see, we're really in a fascinating situation. This is one of those situations, kind of like greet each other with a holy kiss. How many of us have ever done that? See, it's just not part of our culture. We say holy handshake, I guess. I mean, we do the thing that the kiss represented with a handshake. That's our culture. But, and so you read that verse sometimes, greet one another with a holy kiss, and you kind of shake your head and go, I wonder if I'm supposed to be doing that. I wonder if that's part of our culture. Well, I don't think it is. And the same thing here. I don't know, since we don't have enough information, what do? Forge ahead or say, well, we're just going to have to let this one go. And I'm not sure. I mean, you could form, you could create deaconesses here. You could create all kinds of interesting things, but we don't have enough information to go there. And what do we do as a people when we don't know? We can't add to it. George?
Well, it seems to me from the context that the widow indeed would be someone who could not at all support herself. And that would be perhaps kind of like Virgil mentioned, that we read in Acts about the provision for the Gentile widows, that it is something similar to what they did there, was feeding and clothing, if you will, people who couldn't at that time do their own, doing the same thing. And if you go back in history, it was a totally different situation for a woman to support herself than it is today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and but if a woman is 30 years old, her husband is killed, she doesn't have any financial needs, she has three children at home, but they're too young to help, she comes to the church and says, I don't know what I'm going to do. What's the church going to say? Whether it's elders or the men of the congregation, what are they going to say? We're going to help you.
Yes.
Do we say, are you 60? Have you brought up children? Have you, sorry, we can't help you. I mean, are we going to do that? So, as I say, there's the widow indeed, and then there's the woman who's enrolled, widow who's enrolled. And George is right. I mean, we would, in a culture where we don't have Social Security, health insurance, life insurance, car insurance, da-da-da, everything, nothing can go wrong without people being compensated. It makes it more complicated. In the days when they didn't have that, the church had to step in, and the brethren had to make sure that they were giving enough to take care of those needs. And as I say, that covers pretty well up to verse 8. But when we get to verse 9, and we get to this widow who is over 60, which is pretty evident what that means. I mean, you know whether you're over 60 or... Carl?
Yeah, not so long ago, the newscast came over, said there was over 100 charitable organizations in the state of Colorado. Over 100 charitable.
Right.
So there is no need for the church to have to be burdened with anything in our culture.
Right. Unless, I mean, I guess you could imagine a situation where it could happen. I've seen situations where a house burns down and the people know that they're going to be reimbursed, but it's not going to be for a few weeks. And what does the church do? Church steps up. I think during this last hurricane, a lot of people didn't have that kind of insurance, and so the churches were helping those people. So, yeah, you know, there's people that slip through the net, but for the most part, I agree with you, Carl, and that's why I think we take such a dim view when somebody comes into the church building needing help. You kind of figure they've already exhausted all the things that the government gives, and they're just looking for extra. And it's hard sometimes to make that decision. Laura?
Well, and a lot of the needs that arise will be temporary. The majority, I think this is obviously dealing with, you know, long term for the rest of her life, this specific, you know, that's why it's so, I've taken it that way.
Right. Well, the enrolled part, yeah, but what does Paul say the younger women should do? Plan on being taken care of the church for the rest of their life?
No. I mean, for the older, the widow that's 60 and older, takes the pledge, whatever. It's a very small, specific, because the rest of it, like you said, the younger widows can remarry or whatever. And so this widow, this one specific widow, is a very rare thing, because in a lot of situations, things even, you know, they can find something. So there's some other avenue where they'll be taken
right.
care of.
Well, evidently, this pledge is, I'll never remarry. Evidently, this pledge is, I will spend the rest of my life caring for the things of the Lord. I mean, we could kind of combine some of the things that Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 about the woman who's married cares about the things for her husband. The woman who is unmarried cares about the things of the Lord. So, but as I say, not just any woman can do this. She has to be over 60, but that's not even enough. She has to be the wife of one man. Okay, so if she's been married twice, which, you know, we have the same issue here as we do with an elder. If an elder has a wife and she dies and he marries another wife, does he have two wives or one wife?
One.
So some congregations say if his wife died, he could still be an elder if he remarried. Other congregations say no, it's one woman, period, not one woman at a time. And, you know, as I say, congregations take different views. Same thing here. But it's interesting that she has to have the proper marital relationships. If she doesn't have the proper marital relationships, can she be enrolled? No. So that woman of Samaria who had had so many, and now the guy she was living with wasn't her husband, could she be enrolled?
No.
No. And that's the situation here. A lot of women today couldn't be enrolled because of this situation. So she has to be the wife of one husband or one man. She has to be well reported of for good works. I mean, she has a reputation of being out among the congregation. Now, look in your own life, women. Do you have a good reputation? I mean, if somebody were to say, what do you do? And she, well, just ask all the ladies here and you'll know what I'm doing. That's the kind of idea here. She's well reported for good works. Now, you remember Dorcas? Was she well reported of for good works?
Yeah.
Yeah, all widows came to talk about the things that she'd done for them. And so, again, this is a kind of a good criteria for somebody who wants to be considered a worthy woman. This widow is well reported for good works. And then she's brought up children. So her children are raised. And then you say, well, if they're raised, why aren't they taking care of her? And then you say, well, they must be dead or they must be so far away they can't take care of her. But she's brought up children. Does it say whether they're members of the church or not, whether they're believing or faithful or anything? No, just says she brought up children. Lodged strangers. This is the same concept as given to hospitality. She is very actively or was very actively involved in taking care of people who came into the congregation, whether they were strangers or whether they were members of the congregation. Again, depending on your translation, some of the later translations just have hospitality, given to hospitality, because that's basically what the word means. Wash the saints' feet. What does that mean? You think this has become an idiom in the culture of the church, or do you think that they were still washing people's feet? Could be either, right?
When you received people into your home back then, this was something you did. So I think it goes with lodging strangers. You'd wash their feet.
Okay. So can we do that today? Okay, and it just like the holy kiss, right? Washing feet is kind of like the holy kiss. You have somebody in your home, would you like something to drink? Would you like something to eat? Would you like to take a bath? I mean, whatever it takes to make the person comfortable, that's what you do. I'm sorry, whose hand was up? Oh, Carl?
Yeah, I was just going to say, it just simply means to administer help in wherever it's needed.
Okay, yeah, it means to make them comfortable. If their feet are dirty, wash their feet. If their feet aren't dirty, but their hands are dirty, then talk about washing their hands. If their clothes are dirty, tell them that. Now, keep in mind, is this after she's a widow or is this before she's a widow? Is she going to have people in her home after she's a widow?
No.
Probably not. I mean, obviously, there's some decorum here. So, unless they're all women, but how many women are traveling in that day and age? All right, so she brought up children, lodged strangers, washed saints' feet, relieved the afflicted. Okay, so whenever there's a need, that person's going to be there. You just count on it. Whenever there's a need in the congregation, that person will be there to relieve it, and that's why she will be well reported for good work. So, again, this is a pretty good criteria of what God would like to see in godly older women, is that they're actively involved in these things, reported for good works, lodging strangers or hospitality, washing the saints' feet, taking care of their needs, relieving the afflicted. We kind of do this. I mean, if there's somebody going to have a surgery or somebody's going to have an issue, generally we put together a list and people can volunteer for the list. And the people who are involved in that, obviously, are going to know they're doing it and they're going to be well reported of it. Okay, diligently followed every good work. How do we assess that? Well reported of for good works, diligently followed good works. Any difference? Well, one's known and the other is, she might know, her close friends might know, but, you know, it's like Jesus said, if you're going to give alms, if you're going to do good deeds, do you want to blow a trumpet? Here, look at me. No, we don't do that. But like he said later, he said, let your light shine so men can see your good works. So, again, this is something that this woman's character will manifest. So, these are the qualities. It's kind of interesting. In verses 9 and 10, you have the good qualities. In verses 11 through 14, you have the bad qualities. And you can kind of assess whether you're a good woman or a bad woman, depending on which of these categories that you fall into. Because there are women, verse 13, who have learned to be idle. There are women who wander about from house to house. There are women who are not only idle, but gossips, busybodies, saying things that they shouldn't say. So which woman are you? You know, I mean, if the situation arose. Okay, so as I say, as we look at verses 9 through 10, we have a situation that unfortunately we just don't fully understand. We don't see it anywhere. Dorcas could have been one of those, but it doesn't say she was a widow. It doesn't say she was enrolled. Those widows in Acts 6 could have been those widows, but it doesn't say what they were doing. It doesn't say they were enrolled. The only other widows that we find are the ones here. And so we're kind of in a spot where God has given us just enough information for us to be perplexed and curious and interested, but not enough information to practically put it into practice. So this puts us in a bind. So if the congregation, however, said in their own hearts, this is something, I mean, it's kind of like Hebrews 10. When we read, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together, what do we necessarily infer there? All of this, right? The church building, lights, pews, podium, bathrooms. I mean, do we get a lot of mileage out of don't forsake the assembly together? Yeah. Are we wrong? That's a rhetorical question. Of course we're not wrong. But I'm just saying that if we can do that with Hebrews chapter 10, then, you know, there's some things that could be done here, but we'd have to be very careful, and we certainly couldn't bind it on the rest of the churches or the rest of the country. Virgil? I'm sorry, Carl, you had Janet first, and then I'll go to Virgil.
We have some things, as we were saying this morning, that are kind of cloudy, but other scriptures give us a very strict guideline as not to play fast and loose with the Lord's money.
Right.
I know churches that has done that.
Oh, definitely. And we can't use the Lord's money for anything that he's...
And it has been coming out of the pockets of the leaders. They wouldn't have done it, I don't think. But since it's the church's money, they don't feel no pain, see?
Yeah. Virgil?
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Hebrews 10, 25. Or 24, 25, I think it's a kind of a parallel in a sense. There's a responsibility that's there. And the authority then to fulfill this responsibility is couched within these passages. If we don't have authority for what we do, then we're running amok right off the bat. And we do have authority here, we see, to take care of widows. Now we have to take and make a determination, like you stated, where do we go from there? And, of course, that will, a lot of it will be with the circumstances that's involved with it. I don't know how far you go with it.
Right. Yeah, and that's why nobody's gone with it.
But we still have authority to do it.
Yes.
If we need to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when a congregation goes to a 65-year-old widow and says, we think it's about time you get married, and she go here and say, you know, you can't force me to do that.
No.
Now, if a woman's under 60, what do we say? We think it's about time to get married. I mean, we would take care of you for 5 years or 10 years, and Paul said that younger widows should get married. So can you go and tell widows that? Are you busybody? Are you intervening in something that you don't have any business with? No, what did Paul say? I want younger widows to marry. Now, the same word here is the one in 1 Timothy chapter 2 where Paul said, I desire that men pray in every place and that women adorn themselves in modest apparel. So it's the same word for desire. It's the word bulimai, which means a wish or a desire, but it's elevated here because when Paul has a desire, where'd that desire come from? Came from the Holy Spirit, right? So this isn't just Paul's desire, this is the Holy Spirit's desire. Paul commands, Paul sets forth, younger widows marry. So a congregation can go to a younger widow and say, look, we're not going to take care of you for the rest of your life. You need to be looking to get remarried. Is that okay? Yeah, we're told to do that. But if it's an older widow who's 65, 70 years old, what authority do we have? See, we don't have any authority to do that. Now, what pledge can we ask from her? I don't know. I don't know what pledge is. We'll take care of you the rest of your life, but we want you actively involved doing the things that are mentioned here. And so this is a pledge. This is a responsibility. We're going to take care of you. But, you know, if a man won't work, neither let him eat. So there's responsibilities here based on the qualifications. Obviously, there's a work that can be done. Darlene?
Well, and a widow should have the right thinking, the right mind, that she doesn't want to be a burden on the church for a long time.
Right.
She should have that desire to work for her food, to take care of her family. And these days, there's so many ways you can earn money, even if you need to stay home with the kids.
Right.
A lot of work jobs and things that you can do to not be a burden on the church. But I can see for a temporary, we have to get used to the new situation and, you know, less finance and things. But in their heart, in their mind, they should have that goal to take care of themselves and not be a burden on the church. So it shouldn't go on too long if the widow is properly thinking.
And that would be true in our culture and in our society. But in most places in the world, can a widow find work? I mean, in Malawi, if a woman loses her husband, she's not going to be able to go find a job. She's not going to be able to take care of herself. Someone's going to have to help her, or she's going to have to get remarried, or something's going to have to happen. And I think that was true back then, too. I mean, how many times in the history of the world have women been out in the workforce? It's possible, but this passage is pretty clear that these widows have made a pledge, and they're not going to go find a job. They're going to be taken care of by the congregation. So, you know, and you're right, Darlene. I mean, that would be the best solution. But can the church bind that? See, this passage is pretty clear. If she has all these qualities. Anyway, as I say, it's interesting to talk about, and it's interesting to ponder. Fortunately, do we have this situation? See, until you have a situation, you have to figure it out. But do you need to have kind of a semi-plan of what you're going to do if should the situation arise? And that's what these passages are for. George?
Verse 12 you mentioned, as the American Standard says, their first pledge. The King James says first faith, which would imply their pledge to God when they became a Christian, if you will. Do you know why the American Standard uses pledge versus?
Yeah, I'm trying to find it because I did a lot of work on that yesterday. Let me see if I can find it. Okay, here's the breakdown. The ASV, first pledge. New American Standard has previous pledge. NIV has first pledge. New King James and ESV have former faith. And it is the Greek word for faith. So it's up to, I guess, your own interpretation whether, as you say, this is the first her first faith, meaning her confession that Jesus is the Son of God, or whether it is a pledge. But with verse 11 in mind, refuse the younger widows, for when they have begun to grow wanton against Christ, they desire to marry. Now, that's an interesting construction because the word wanton means feeling sexual desires. When she begins to feel sexual desires. But here it's opposed or against Christ. Well, why would a younger widow's sexual desires that would lead her to want to marry, why would that have anything to do with her becoming a Christian? See, and that's where you go, okay, now, because as I say, the context of the casting off is based on the statement that whatever they have cast off was based on growing wanton against Christ and desiring to marry. That's why you have to refuse them, because this is going to happen. I mean, we see this all the time. People going through a situation where their spouse dies or they get into a divorce situation and they always say, never going to remarry, right? And then after a few years, what happens? You know, they get over their grief and they think they want to marry. So that's why Paul says you need to refuse the younger widow. But the fascinating thing is, why would her desires for sexual activity in the marriage relationship be against Christ. And of course, there's nothing in her first obedience to the gospel that would require that. And that's why many of the later translations have, you know, helped us out, I guess, because it can mean pledge. It can mean faith or it can mean pledge. So, but the condemnation comes because they've cast off their first pledge or their first faith. So, again, you know, George is right, and you can kind of work it out in your own mind which way you want to go with it. But whatever it is they're rejecting because they want to get married. And if I become a Christian and I decide I want to get married, am I rejecting anything? See, I'm not. So that's why you kind of, you're like I say, I mean, you're just kind of boxed in every direction, but you don't have enough information to draw a proper conclusion. All right, let's go ahead and finish up here, verse 13, with what these widows are, or these younger widows are doing. They learn to be idle. How do you learn to be idle?
Practice it.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. You have to practice it. I mean, if you're married and you have children and you're up to your neck, can you learn to be idle? I guess you could, but most women learn to be idle. No, they become very diligent. But after when your husband's gone and you don't have any children, then what? Can you learn to be idle? Church is taking care of your financial needs and you don't have anything to do. So you learn to be idle. Wandering about from house to house. In other words, you just don't have anything to do. I'm going to go see so-and-so and see so-and-so and see so-and-so and spend my whole day out and about. But unfortunately, not only idle, but gossips and busybodies. Now, the word gossip in our language kind of has a negative connotation, but it really doesn't have a negative connotation in the Greek language. It comes from the word throwing up bubbles. Okay, so when you get done with your conversation and you've just thrown up a bunch of bubbles, what does that mean? Is there any substantive in this conversation? Anything of any value in this conversation? That's what gossip is. Now, it can move toward slander, but often it's just passing on information. However, should that information always be passed on?
No.
There's things that should be kept. In other words, I go over to so-and-so's house and I find out her problems, and I take them over to this person's house and I find out her problems. I'm talking about as a widow now, not as a preacher, but as a widow, I go to this person's house and I find out this information. Next conversation I have, I get to pass all that on, and then I get some more information, and then I get to pass that on, and pretty soon, we've thrown up a lot of bubbles, and God doesn't want that. He does not want people sitting around blowing bubbles all day with their tongue, talking about silly things, trifling things, vain things. It's just a waste of time. And it generally leads to this next one, which is busybody, which is, it's a Greek word for it's got the word perimeter in it. What do I say? If I'm walking around the perimeter, what do you understand me to be doing? I'm walking around the edge. But this is walking around the edge of work. So this word busybody means I'm skirting around the edge of work in my talk. And as I'm busy going around the perimeter, I start getting into other people's business. Start talking about other people's business. And so now again, is there anything negative about this? I mean, is it always negative to go talking about people's problems to other people? If I share my problems with you, don't you have the right to go share those problems with somebody else?
No.
Yeah, I don't. If I wanted them shared, I'd come before the congregation and tell them. I'm telling you, thinking it's in confidence. Yeah. But what are you doing? You're passing it around, and unfortunately, like that game you play where you start in the back and you come up, as it gets passed around, what happens?
Jesus.
It starts getting a whole lot worse and a whole lot different, and pretty soon it comes back to the person who said it, and they're going, I never said that. Carl?
There used to be an old song said, I heard it through the grapevine.
Yeah.
And that's similar to gossip.
Right, yeah, that's similar to gossip. You know, for years I was a kid, we lived where the grapevine was, and I never could figure out how you could hear anything through the grapevine, because I went through the grape vineyards and I had no idea. I was probably in my mid-20s when I finally figured out what that song was talking about. Okay, so they learn to be idle. They're wandering about from house to house. They're not only idle, but gossips and busybodies, saying things which they should not say. Therefore, I desire, there's that same word, I desire, that's in 1 Timothy 2:8, that the younger widows marry, bear children, manage the household, and give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully. Manage the house is kind of an interesting concept. You know, a lot of times people talk about the authority of the husband, but this passage talks about the authority of the wife. It's, have you ever heard the term despot? Anybody know what a despot is? Okay, it's a ruler who has absolute control over a country. So Saddam Hussein was a despot over that country, Iraq, while he was there. He had absolute control. This is the word oikodespotes. And so it means a ruler of a household. Now, in the noun form, it primarily talks about, you remember the householder that Jesus talks about all the time in the gospel, the householder who sends out his servants, who has stewards, who possesses things, and he's the person in control. Well, for some reason, Paul decides to use that same word to describe what women, after they marry, after these younger widows marry and bear their children, they're supposed to manage or rule over the house. Which, I mean, it goes without saying, when the husband's not there and the mom's there and the kids are there, who has authority? The mom does. When the husband's not there and it's time to go to the grocery store or go to the market to buy things, who makes those decisions? Who's the one in the worthy woman? She's doing a lot of things. She's buying the field. She's making assessments. She's doing certain activities. She's over her servants, allocating information. So this concept that the husband has total authority and the wife doesn't have any authority is completely put on its ear here because of the term he uses. So this particular word is something that we all need to carefully look at because it kind of breaks down the chain of command in the home. The husband is at the head. But the wife is given the leeway and the right to be a steward over the household and to manage it and to rule over it. So, and then give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully. Are people out there looking to say something bad about us? Why? Why were the Jews so interested in finding something bad they could say about Jesus?
Discredited.
Okay, they don't like what he's saying. They don't approve of him. They want to discredit him. They bring false witnesses in. They're trying to find a way to bring him down. And what happens? They can't find it. So they finally ask him, "Are you the Christ?" And he says, "I am." And they speak reproachfully about that. Well, that's their problem, not his problem. He spoke the truth. But if, and we've talked about this so many times in the past, if a preacher's in a grocery store and he's got a fifth of whiskey in his grocery cart, is he giving offense? Is he giving people occasion to revile? Yeah. If a younger widow does the things that are listed here, it's going to reflect on the church. That church, it takes care of these widows, and these widows are out doing all kinds of things that they shouldn't be doing. So Paul says, don't give them that opportunity. And this is something, you know, Paul says in another place, we give thought for things honorable in the sight of all men. In other words, before you do something, what's one of the considerations whether you do it or not?
Does it bring reproach in the church?
Yeah. Will this cause an issue? Will this create a situation where people are going to say, I would never be a member of the Church of Christ because da-da-da-da-da-da. And there's a lot of those out there. I've heard them, you've heard them. And some of them are true in the sense that that should have never happened. But does that mean you shouldn't be a member of the Church of Christ just because there's one wicked person here the Lord's already cast off? See, and that's what's always, well, I guess the word amuse isn't the right word, but that's always what's amazed me. Why do you take it out on Jesus Christ what his ungodly, unfaithful members are doing? Does that make any sense? You know, to take it out on the one perfect person when, you know, and basically you're taking it out on yourself as well. Okay.
That's Carl? Just a mechanism that Satan uses.
Yeah. It's the perfect rationalization that people like to use to create a situation where they don't have to do something. And they do it all the time. I mean, in school, if you're a straight A student and they start calling you names, why are they calling you names?
Because they're not straight A students.
Because they can't do it. And they're not going to feel bad, so you're the bad person for doing that. And somehow, well, I don't know why, but that makes people feel better when they can find something wrong with those people who are trying to do better than they are. Did I see him? Okay, Charles and then Carl.
Yeah, I think it has something to do also, too, with the fact that a lot of people say one bad apple spoils the whole barrel. They yep. look at something that does happen, and for a member of the church or whatever, then they'll say that everybody there is the same way.
Right. So. Okay. Carl?
The culture's changed because when I was a teenager, we admired straight-A students.
Yeah, yeah, they were valedictorians, and they were considered, and they still are by a lot of people, but there's some people who, what do we call it, sour grapes? You know, you're eating those grapes, but they're probably sour, so I'm glad I don't get to eat them, even though I really like them. All right, any other questions or thoughts? Thank you.